You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 7th of June 2017 on Monocle 24. Live from London on Monocle 24, this is Midori House. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's programme...
As we see the threat changing, evolving, becoming more complex, we need to ensure that our police and our security and intelligence agencies have the powers they need.
It's election eve here in Britain, and while the odds favour Theresa May's ruling Conservative Party, no one is really sure quite what to expect. Meanwhile, China flexes its military muscles with a series of new international bases. And...
For too long, we in Washington have been lying to you. We say we're here to serve you, when in fact, we're serving ourselves.
But has Frank Underwood's thunder been stolen by the real-world antics of Donald Trump's White House? And we'll tune in our dials to MSNBC to find out why ratings there are suddenly skyrocketing. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Yes, a warm welcome to today's Midori House. My guests are Isabel Hilton, editor of China Dialogue, and George Brock, professor of journalism at City University here in London, a former journalist for The Observer and The Times. Welcome both to the programme. Very good to have you with us. Now, when Britain's Prime Minister Theresa May called tomorrow's snap election, she was enjoying a healthy lead in the polls, as high as 20 points at one point. That might as well have been a generation ago, because as the polls stand today... Tomorrow's result will be, well, certainly much tighter than many had expected. George, I'll come to you first of all. Clearly, we need to wait and see what happens tomorrow. But there is a temptation, isn't there, looking at how the polling's changing, generally how the mood is changing, to speculate as to whether Theresa May made a strategic error here.
It's possible that she did. I think the odds, kind of slightly boring odds, are that she probably will increase her majority. But it is such weird political weather that I feel, I think for almost the first time in my life, really quite sympathetic to the pollsters. their job is now almost impossible. There is so much changing along so many different axes that it is that really, because they're regarded as soothsayers who can see into the future... The expectations are way, way above what they can actually do. I think she is probably far enough ahead to expand her majority. How that will be treated in politics, whether that will be treated as a failure or a success, that's a slightly different question. She could have a bigger majority and it could still be regarded as a failure.
And we'll have to wait and see, I guess, what happens tomorrow. Isabel, on that point, though, that George makes about this weird political weather, the climate is definitely rather strange. I'm still trying to... get used to the idea of a Corbyn-led Labour Party promising more police officers than the Tories, for example, or faring rather well in the debates around security that we've been touching upon. And I find myself saying, what's happening here?
I know. I mean, one thing that's happened, I think Theresa May would have to have a really thumping majority for this not to be seen as a damaging exercise, because you have this bizarre... She pitched it as a contest between herself, strong and stable, competent, de-dum-de-dum, and Jeremy Corbyn, shambling, incompetent, you wouldn't trust the country to him. And as each has been exposed, what we've discovered is that the electorate actually rather like Jeremy Corbyn, who comes across as a warm human being and is speaking to a lot of the frustrations and difficulties that people have been experiencing. The more they see of Theresa May, in contrast, the more she comes across as a speak your weight machine, you know, repeating a series of clearly targeted, you know, little sound bites. And she has not fared well. There are so many imponderables in this election. Brexit hangs over it. It's hardly been discussed. The economy has hardly had a look in. Everyday issues and anxieties about things like social care have been paramount. And there's a feeling, I think, that whatever your doubts about a Corbyn-led Labour Party, and people have huge doubts, he at least understands what ordinary people, what taxpayers and ordinary people are feeling. And there is no sense that she does. So there are a lot of imponderables here. My own feeling is that it will be and this is, you know, hostage to fortune, it'll be a narrow Tory win which will resolve nothing.
Well, and that rather speaks volumes for where politics is getting us in the UK at the moment. George, a couple of interesting things strike me there from what Isabel was saying. One is this idea around likeability, if you like, and Corbyn has proved himself to be a more likeable politician, certainly than Theresa May. Another point she, Isabel, mentioned there was about this the Tory hash over social care. Are the two things linked? You know, was there a bit of, frankly, a bungled manifesto from the Tories? Whereas actually, it's rather surprising, Corbyn's manifesto wasn't very Corbyn. It actually had some fairly Ed Miliband stuff in there. It had some pretty palatable things in there. Is that why he's more likable? Is the manifesto better than Theresa May's?
Actually, I think the Tories made, and these were conservative, unforced errors, in my view. I think they made two separate mistakes. One was to present Theresa May as the strong, stable, authoritative leader. She doesn't chat to journalists. She's not particularly smiley, and so on, and that, you know, a tough leader was what you need in this difficult Brexit negotiations, counter-terrorism, whatever the particular aspect they were riffing off, forgetting that there is an awful lot of experience to say that people don't like voting for people who they can't imagine talking to in the pub. Quite, that's the simplest way pollsters can put it, but generally speaking, that is a really, really big advantage. And Cameron just about had some of that advantage. You could see him. He was a loose-limbed, relaxed, chilled out famously, and so on. And he had a little bit of that, and he made some advantage with it. And I think Ed Miliband always had trouble with that. Corbyn, of course, personally, as Isabel quite rightly says, has come across as very calm, quite relaxed, can take a lot of the pressure that's thrown at him, and so on. I mean, the Labour Party's problems are not Corbyn. They're policies, and do they add up, and all that kind of stuff. But I think on social care, they just made a classic strategic error. Never ever introduce a potentially very difficult policy right in the middle of an election. Lots of experience. You know, they're not very good at taking experience advice.
Why do you think that they did that? Because it was certainly, to me, it looked like an issue that was best kicked into the long grass and picked up after, especially when it looked like it was going to be a coronation. Why on earth did they tie themselves in such knots? It's not a blunder one would associate with what likes to style itself as, you know, the party of government or whatever.
Absolutely.
Else.
But I think it is a blunder that you can associate with Theresa May's modus operandi. I mean, she has spent most of her senior political career in the Home Office running a very narrow ship, if you like, with two trusted advisers whom she took to Downing Street. She's not collegiate. You remember when she actually issued the letter triggering Article 50, it was only read to the Cabinet, you know, hours before it was delivered. Well, hang on a minute. Shouldn't the Cabinet have had a say in it? Might we not have avoided the blunder over Gibraltar? So her two trusted advisers themselves don't have experience of the wider, more collegiate aspects of being Prime Minister. It's very different from being Home Secretary. In addition to that, Theresa May was being sold as the safe pair of hands, the competence, the strength, and all of that, which is all right. It's not very fuzzy and appealing. But then you have two terror attacks in the middle of the campaign. And who was running the Home Office? Who had been in charge, really, of domestic security for many years? Theresa May. It didn't look good. So the competence, of course, is called into question. She didn't do very well, I think, when challenged on those issues, the issue of cutting police numbers, of running the intelligence services, all this kind of thing. And then the panic announcement last night that they were going to challenge or remove Britain from certain aspects of the Human Rights Act in order to deal with domestic terrorism. It's unconvincing. It smacks of someone who is really surprisingly unsure-footed, actually.
Well, and on that point, and I think you've both alluded to the Brexit negotiations, which will finally, well, one assumes Theresa May, given what's going to happen tomorrow, will get round to. Not sure-footed, indecisive, wobbly where she wanted to be perceived as stable. George, do you think that if we look across the channel, people will be rather, I don't know if enjoying is the right word, but they will have looked at her performance as a prime minister in the last few weeks and said, do you know what, this is probably going to be a more straightforward negotiation than we thought, certainly an easier one.
I think they certainly think the opposite. They're liable to draw the conclusion that the opposite, that their negotiating partner is not going to be as difficult as they perhaps thought. Mm. But it can cut two ways. I mean, brittle and indecisive can make a negotiating partner more difficult. I don't think... Frankly, I think people across the channel only want one thing, which is a government with a reasonably large majority. They're not unlikely to be specifying exactly how much. They wouldn't really mind, providing it was a government that could see the whole process through. I think that's actually their only requirement. Weird political weather is going on in France as well, don't forget.
Well, no, perhaps we'll touch on that in a minute. Isabel, on that point you were making about Theresa May's quite sort of limited inner circle, this reliance on one or two people, her inner cabal quite narrow. It's quite narrow in terms of its experience as well. And if we look at something like negotiations about future relationship with the EU, one would have imagined it would be prudent to draw in lots of influence, somebody with a rather more broad-minded view. A lot of people have pointed out the lack of language skills even across the cabinet now when we're compared to some of their predecessors who had experience working in Brussels. Do you think we can come unstuck on that basis as well, just through a lack of, whatever you'd call it, negotiating savvy and relevant skills?
I think it's deeply worrying, actually. And there's been a steady downgrading of the Foreign Office over 15 years in this country, at least. And, you know, the outsourcing more and more of foreign policy to PwC and other entities. This is not helpful at this moment. We know that we don't have trade negotiators, but actually the degree of misunderstanding or lack of understanding of how the EU actually works that you perceive in British politics is extremely worrying for anyone going into negotiations. And if you go and talk to people in Brussels, including Brits who work in the Commission, they're very, very worried at how little is understood in London, simply of how things work and what the implications are of the negotiations. And I think that is particularly true of Theresa May. I don't think she's had a great deal to do with abroad in any respects. There was another interesting remark. Nicola Sturgeon, the leader of the SNP, said of Theresa May, she's clearly, this is not an unbiased view, but she observed that the negotiations go better when you're negotiating with someone you find easy to talk to. And in her experience of meeting Theresa May, she's not an easy woman to talk to. If you don't warm to the people across the table, you know, read, you know, any manual on negotiating, you know, first you have to win the trust. It's not a battle. It is a battle, but it's a battle best fought through seduction rather than confrontation.
And just, you mentioned Nicola Sturgeon and Scotland, just on a sort of domestic or narrative in terms of the election, support for Scottish independence has dropped. The Tories potentially could make some gains in Scotland. Again, it seems like a strange thing to be saying. Is this a big moment tomorrow for Scotland and maybe for this idea of the ongoing push for Scottish independence?
Well, we'll see. I mean, another amongst the many anomalies of this election is that the SNP, the Party of Independence, has been the party least likely to bring the subject up in this election campaign. The party most likely to bring it up are the Tories, and that's because they are firmly unionist party. So that if you are a disaffected Scottish voter and you are in favour of Brexit, then you're likely to vote Tory. I don't think Labour is going to get much of a comeback. But, you know, the Tories at least have a clearly different position from the SNP. And don't forget, the SNP won, last time they won, what, all but two seats in Scotland. So, you know, it wouldn't be surprising if a few were clawed back. The Tories in Scotland have a particularly dynamic and interesting leader, and I think she has done a fantastic job of you know, changing the Tory image, which used to be toffs, landed gentry, you know, that kind of thing. It's certainly not toffs and landed gentry now. It's deeply politically engaged, and she has a political message which is rather clearer than the message that's coming out of Westminster.
Just one footnote on the campaign. Notice how few businessmen are supporting the government. It's something that hasn't happened. Normally it does. Normally you get big corporate titans coming out saying, I would much prefer to say, usually the Conservatives they're backing, occasionally they back Blair in the past and so on, but you know, some of them are prepared to come over the parapet and give their choice. this campaign, I cannot remember a single leading businessman.
But it's because they're deeply worried about Brexit. Well,
they're, so they're, no, of course, because they're just horrified. Worried about Brexit.
They are worried. They are worried about Brexit. But that does show a very disengaged and fed up business community about what is about to happen.
Well, I don't feel that much better after having that conversation, frankly. Let's move on and see if we can do any better with China, where the nation's military might is in for a boost. Plans in place for a set of new international bases. A report by the Pentagon indicates that Beijing will seek to expand its global defence influence with a greater emphasis on promoting China's overseas interests. This news comes as the country's president poured cold water on Donald Trump's ditching of the Paris Climate Change Agreement by signing a deal with the Californian governor aimed at reducing emissions. Isabel, it's funny, we talk about changeable political weather in this country. We see China now maybe trying to lead the way in defence terms with these new bases. Climate change, can it be in the vanguard? Is there a definitive shift potentially ahead here?
Well, it's definitely in the vanguard in some respects in climate change, and has been actually for some time. A lot of what is in this report is noting things that have been in process for some time. So in China, I'm sure you've read the 12th five-year plan and possibly the 13th five-year plan. So you will not be surprised to know that China has been deeply committed to climate action for quite a long time now. Partly because they understand basic physics, they know the dangers, they're really seriously alarmed, they're the world's biggest emitter, but also because they know that the technologies of the future are low-carbon technologies and they want to be the supplier of the goods and services to a carbon-constrained world. So they have a strategic interest in this stuff, they have an economic interest in this stuff, and they get it. Also, Trump's behaviour has given them the opportunity to be the responsible global player.
I was
going to
say, do they actually welcome his rhetoric? Because it provides a sort of opportunity to play the good guy.
They play the good guy, which is hard for China. It's slightly premature in that what they don't want to do is to step up. And the bit that will be missing without the United States is that sort of use of diplomacy, sometimes coercively, to keep everybody in line. You know, you're trying to keep a big, baggy, multilateral process on the road. China isn't used to do that. It'll be in the slipstream. It'll be supportive. But being out in the lead on that is something that China has had little experience of. And the problem with being the kind of global leader, global player is, as we saw with the EU-China meeting last week, that then people start making demands of you. So if China is committed to open markets, come on, China, open your market. You know, that's the kind of thing you get. And China's not quite ready to do that yet. On the military front, the biggest development really, China used to have the biggest land-based army in the world, which was, you know, baggy and efficient, beaten by Vietnam, for heaven's sake. And now it's slimmed that down. It's got much more strategic. So it looks at cyberspace and it looks at marine. So submarine, which is about denial of access for the United States, and a big blue water navy, because now China has enormous supply lines to defend. It has energy supply lines. It has goods and services that go by sea. So for the last many years now, China has been quietly buying up ports all across the Pacific, in the near abroad. So one in Sri Lanka, one in crucial one in Pakistan, in Gwadar, and one in Djibouti, right next to an American base. And China is building naval installations there. So China has just quietly become a naval power.
It's become a naval power, George, and it's attempting, as Isabel describes there, to sort of be at the forefront of some of these discussions. And it is almost impossible to look at what China does and how it does it without somehow comparing and contrasting with the United States. And again, it seems to throw into sharp relief some of Trump's strategic pronouncements, be they on climate change or just how the US engages with the world, because you can see, I think, as Isabel describes very well there, you know, China making strides. The US will surely, on that front, pay for Trump's inability to see the big picture, won't it, even in the short term?
I think the American withdrawal from things certainly will cost it, and it may cost everyone else. I think we've got to be a little bit careful about seeing how far this process has gone so far, if you see what I mean. Take, just as an instance, today's really kind of dangerous crisis, which is an apparently ISIS attack in Tehran. The Iranian authorities have said that Saudi Arabia was behind this. Now, that's a very considerable escalation of hostilities, both armed and verbal, in that situation. The Americans, as it were, even with Trump in charge, still, in that part of the world, have some diplomatic leverage, which is related also to military assets they have there. Now, you know, it's quite a long time before any other superpower is going to have that kind of leverage and those sorts of assets. We're not really quite at that stage yet. But it could be that there is a twin process started, American withdrawal, long, steady Chinese advance towards assets and leverage, which will shift the balance eventually. But, you know, this, the kind of the building up of that kind of leverage is by its nature quite a slow process.
And one that the Chinese actually don't, they say they don't want to be that kind of superpower. The degree to which they'll be forced into it is an open question at this point.
Is that slightly disingenuous, though? Because surely it's part and parcel of being at the forefront, whether you're an economic powerhouse or anything else, to sort of pick up this other slack. Huh?
It is, but it's something that China has no historic experience of. It does have a security problem. One belt, one road. The one road, bizarrely, is the maritime bit, and we talked about that. One belt goes through some of the most difficult and dodgy parts of the planet. You know, they're building infrastructure through Baluchistan, through Pakistan-occupied Kashmir, into Central Asia. They have the world's third largest copper deposit in Afghanistan. They have security issues that will preoccupy them in the near abroad, I think, for some time. I don't think the projection of force any further than that is going to be within their capacity or within their ambition. This is a defensive posture, whereas the United States, you know, after World War II, was very much, you know, putting the world order in place. What worries me is that Trump doesn't seem to know about the American world order and why it matters, and is playing extremely fast and loose with things that have kept the world a reasonably stable and ordered place.
And he may possibly have encouraged Saudi Arabia to get tougher with Iran,
I think,
or use its proxies against it.
He's boasting that he did.
His boasts may be different from the reality, but nevertheless, it's a concerning picture.
He has just been there.
Let's talk a bit more about Trump. Let's talk about the media. He enjoys rather a love-hate relationship with it, outwardly despises the mainstream press while simultaneously commanding their attention with these pronouncements. CBS chairman Les Moonves perhaps summed it up best when he said it may not be good for America, but it's damn good for ratings. And this leads us to talk about, no end to the honeymoon period, if you like, for certainly the US media. 6 months after the inauguration? MSNBC, which was languishing as this sort of left-leaning, a bit of a ghost ratings ghost town, is in the midst of a surge. Figures are 118% up year on year. George, a media success story?
The
revival of the left in American media. It was the top ranking show at times of late.
Well, for journalism, I think the comparison between Fox News and MSNBC, which people often make for understandable reasons, is a little bit unfair. The MSNBC formula is significantly different from the Fox formula. The Fox formula is a complete mixture of opinion and news, or it's news masquerading, or it's opinion masquerading as news. MSNBC do actually make some separation. They tend to cover news reasonably straightforwardly during the day, then they put opinion makers on in the evening, approximately speaking. And their opinion makers are very, very good. And it's hardly surprising, if you have Trump in the White House, that their ratings are going up. I mean, there are a lot of journalists who are awfully hypocritical about Trump, if you see what I mean.
Journalists hypocritical, George? Surely not.
All the time, I'm afraid, in two different senses about Trump. Firstly, Trump is gripping news. There's no point in journalists trying to pretend otherwise. And secondly, what Trump has done and his relationship to the truth does make people ask, how do I know this for sure? Which, for journalism, is a really good question for people to be asking.
Well, and maybe something to celebrate. You know, could this be that it's not just, you know, Democrat voters or sort of metropolitan elite left-wingers who are flocking back to MSNBC, but precisely for the reasons that George has described there, your middle of the road Americans, you know, maybe some traditional Republican voters who just want to know what's going on.
I think that what MSNBC has done rather brilliantly is be very sober and fact-based. And even in the opinion, the Rachel Maddow show, which is pretty compulsive viewing, keeps coming back to the Russia story, and it will periodically assemble everything that we know from the Russia story in order to put it together and say, this is why the Russia story matters. I mean, the Russia-Trump story. And they do this consistently. So if you are bewildered by the shouting match that is going on talk radio or on Fox, which is almost unwatchable because everybody shouts all the time, then, you know, turning to MSNBC is really a relief. You feel that the world suddenly is in a shape that you understand. And I think that has been rather compelling. I mean, I remember MSNBC as rather sort of low production values, you know, kind of camera at the back of a rather dreary conference, you know, watching the slideshow. But gosh, it's come on since then. There was a scoop that I watched in a visit to the United States recently, in which was heavily, heavily overpromoted about Trump's tax returns. Mm. He released, you know, one small part of his tax returns, which showed that he'd paid tax. This was heavily promoted, but it didn't actually, you know, tell you anything at all. So they can be a little too solemn and, you know, portentous for their own good. But on the whole, I think that they are appealing to, I guess, Washington Post readers, New York Times readers, and I would say in general across, if you like, the liberal press, the coverage of Trump, which is forensic, there's a huge appetite for that. Not everyone wants to live in a crazy verse.
And George, just finally on this, do you think the Trump and the Trump White House will be concerned by those figures? You can be pretty sure that he'll be aware of them.
I mean, I'm sure he hates MSNBC just like he hates all of that, all of the other media that, you know, that doesn't worship him, if you see what I mean. This is a man child who depends on approval above all else. So anybody reserving or withdrawing approval, he's just going to carry on hating them. But I repeat, pressure and challenge is generally speaking very good for journalism. Just look at those people who have to write the moving texts at the bottom of the TV screen.
They've never been busy.
They've never had such a fantastic time in their life.
Now, we were going to hear from Frank Underwood, but as time is short, I just want to rattle on through, given I feel this somehow has led us to this conclusion. Many of us are still making our way through season 5, so no spoilers. But this began as a frightening vision of a loose cannon who makes it right to the top. And it feels, Isabel, sort of strangely dated now. I'm talking, of course, about House of Cards, based on the brilliant British original. Has life stopped imitating art and surpassed it altogether?
I think it has rather outflanked art on in
nicely
this
put, nicely
case
put.
Because, you know, Frank Underwood, the premise is that, you know, he was after all a politician, and what it's showing us is that politicians are venal, evil, self-interested and not to be trusted, which I think we feel is a bit of a truism now. But I don't think anyone anticipated that someone like Trump would be elected. It's just way off script, and had anyone put this up as a series, I think, you know, it probably wouldn't have flown. So the essential premise, which is that, you know, you have a political structure which goes a bit rogue in the person of Frank Underwood, has just been outflanked.
And it's interesting, isn't it? You look across different US TV programs, Homeland sort of wrestled with this idea of these protagonists, and we were trying to seek identifiable traits. We said, you know, you can't satirise the unsatirizable. Reality is defeating these Hollywood creatives every time.
You're right about that. The movie that I remember is one called Wag the Dog, written by the brilliant American playwright David Mamet.
Very,
it stars
very
Robert
film.
De Niro as a political operative who is brought in to boost up the sagging ratings of a president who is campaigning. In order to do this, he invents a completely fictitious war in a part of the world which Americans have never heard of and aren't interested in. And it is a brilliant comedy about fakery and so on. I'm more reminded of Trump. I'm more reminded of Wag the Dog than I am of House of Cards, actually.
Well, there you go. That's some watching for our listeners to do before next time to see if they agree with you, George. Thank you both very much indeed. That's all we've got time for. George Brock and Isabel Hilton, thanks for being on the show today. The programme was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Hunter Colton, and our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. More music next. Daniel Giacopelli's here with the entrepreneurs at 1900, and we'll have more on all the day's main news stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200, where perhaps we'll look ahead to James Comey's testimony tomorrow, which we didn't get a chance to talk about, but we'll be interested to hear. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 here in London. Do join us then. It's election day here in the UK. Be sure to tune in. I'm Tom Edwards. Thanks very much for listening.